I don't see Bishop Eaton, but after her Bible study yesterday, yes. I thought the only Christian thing to do was to offer lend this to her for the rest of the week. Now that's what that's for. Okay. My friends mock me. I did a session weekend at Messiah Lutheran Church in Schenectady, New York. And part of that included Journey of the Universe. And I received a packet from them. And included was a letter to me. Now, I'm just going to read you the address. Herr Professor Dr. Larry Rasmussen, Union Theological Seminary, 3041 Broadway at 121st Street, Borough of Manhattan, New York City, County of New York, State of New York, United States of America, North America, Earth Solar System, Milky Way Galaxy, Unakea Supercluster, the Universe, the Mind of God. So that's where I am. And actually, that's where you are too. You're all on the journey. Yeah.
What zip code did they use?
That it isn't even on there. You know. Yeah. So it probably wouldn't have gotten to me if they dropped it into the mailbox itself. All right. Several of the questions that came up from you after our last session clustered around what are the resources? How do we access, for example, the disc Journey of the Universe and the educational interviews that we'll be using? So I put some of these on the whiteboard, and you may need to come up later if you can't read the smaller print. But www.journeyoftheuniverse.org. You can download all of this from YouTube. But just go to that website, and there's a whole lot more. This has taken off, and there are free courses. They're called MOOC courses, massive online courses. Last year, 12,000 people signed up for this free course, two free courses on Journey of the Universe. One was on Thomas Berry, the inspiration of this, himself. So there you can have for as a gift all of the materials that we'll be using and far more. Then there's a good website, lutheransforrestoringcreation.org. I give my friends there a little bit of a hard time. It's a bit overblown. I mean, it's not all of creation. I mean, let's just start with our galaxy. I mean, Lutherans aren't going to take on 100 billion galaxies with 100 billion stars and who knows how many planets. We're capable people. We're not that capable. So it's really Lutherans for restoring a bit of Earth. But it's called Lutherans for Restoring Creation.org. And on that website, there's a whole lot, but are included are resources for congregations. So the third one is greenfaith.org. Green Faith is an interfaith organization focusing on many different programs, one of which is a certification program for houses of worship. So whether it's a church or a mosque or a synagogue or a temple. And then if you join that program, you sign on for 2 years as a congregation to work through requirements in seven different areas, including worship and education, buildings and grounds, community outreach, et cetera, et cetera. It's an amazing program. And you come in with a cohort who signed up at the same time you did. So you're in dialogue with others working on the same requirements over the same 2 years. And there are webinars then with staff from Green Faith. You submit reports and so on. Our congregation did that in Santa Fe, and we haven't been the same since. It took us 18 months of dialogue about what should be our role as in leadership on Earth issues, and that isn't just environment narrowly conceived. That's issues of inclusiveness, issues of our race relations, etc. All of that is included in this, and we have a covenant in the congregation called the Whole Earth Covenant, in which we formally committed ourselves to a set of things that we're are doing. And it wouldn't have happened in the systematic, comprehensive, holistic way it did, apart from the Green Faith program. There's now Green Faith seminary programs, and seminaries are coming on board and doing this as well. Now, we live in Santa Fe, and green is the color you've got to get over if you live in the desert. I mean, if we greened everything, we'd start looking like Phoenix, or try to, or Las Vegas, and we don't want to do that. So we told Fletcher Harper and the staff at Green Faith, we're changing it to desert faith. But you all can have green faith. We'll just do this in our own color. That's all. So, and then there are some books, a very accessible one, Thomas Berry, The Great Work, Our Way into the Future. Every epoch, every age, every civilization has had its great work. For the Roman Empire was knit together the known world at that time and supply structure and law and engineering to bring it together. For India, it was the relationship of the material and the spiritual, the philosophical and the mundane achieved in remarkable ways that continue to this day. So for Native peoples on this continent, Turtle Island, it was to come to terms with the forces of nature as a part of your own identity. That was the great work, is the great work still, of many, many indigenous people. So every civilization has its great work. And Thomas Berry says our great work is to make the great transition from industrial civilization to ecological civilization. So that's, and then what are the elements of that and how do you do it? That's Berry's, The Great Work, Our Way into the Future. Paul Hawken is the editor of a book that I only had a chance to look at yesterday, but even looking through the table of contents and dipping into it, it's extraordinary. It's called Download, A Comprehensive Plan to Combat Global Warming. And what Paul Hawken did was organize good thinkers and practitioners around the world on a whole variety of topics, energy, food, transportation, etc., and lay out the technology that's available, the practices that are available, and put them all together there. That's the book, Download. People ask me, what can we possibly do? And I say, anyone who can Google can be saved. But your alternative to Googling is to go to Download and be saved that way. I put my own book up here, Earth Honoring Faith, Religious Ethics in a New Key. The first half of the book, it isn't about Journey of the Universe. I'm assuming that, and it's back of what I write. But the first half of the book is what are the major changes in our outlook, and especially our sense of moral responsibility that need to happen in order to get from to creation, care and creation, justice. And then the second half of the book, part two, are the religious resources for doing that. The great religions of the world share a lot in common that coalesce as resources for our a viable story for our own time, a viable way to make the great transition to ecological civilization. Mysticism and is shared by the world's religions. There are the common elements there, and it addresses fragmentation. Asceticism, or what's called the world, the simple life, shows up in every religious tradition. It addresses consumerism as a way of life. The sacred addresses the commodified. When you commodify something, put it on the market for sale, you leech the sacred, the mysterious, the numinous out of it. And by and large, our civilization has leached the sacred, the mysterious, the numinous from everything except sometimes human life and human relationships. But this is about all creation. So prophetic liberative traditions and discrimination, oppression. So the second half of the book are the deep shared traditions and resources of world religions in order to make the transition, in order our way into the future. Now, I can't say too much about my own books because, as Nyla knows, Grandma Peterson is always sitting on my shoulder. When my mother said to her mother, my grandmother, after my grandparents celebrated their 62nd anniversary, my mom said, that has to go in the Jackson County Pilot. Got to go in the local newspaper. And Grandma said, wouldn't that be bragging? So I can't brag too much. I can't talk about my books too much or I'll get scolded about bragging. My grandmother thought bragging was one of the seven deadly sins. And on the top of the list, it's not even there. But she, that's where she had it. Okay. The other question that I always get asked besides, related to this, besides, you know, what are some resources are, what can one person do? It's just overwhelming. Well, the answer is stop being one person. This you do together and you have a meaningful and even fun time working together. And that's why something like Green Faith and the program of a congregation or others in your neighborhood, the big changes don't take a lot of people. 12 is a pretty good number. 12 and a rabbi. Pretty much does it. Margaret Mead said all the big changes start with just a little group. Now, let's have some discussion before we turn to the interviews. Okay, we're going to spend more time on the science today for a while in the first disc and hear from people who are the scientists also people studying animals. So we're going to do a little bit more science today, the science of the journey of the universe. You may recall that I said on Monday that there are different kinds of cosmologies. One of them is a cosmology that science provides. But there are religious and cultural cosmologies. And this whole project is an effort to create a dialogue between scientific cosmologies, common creation story, and the traditions of various religions. So I've kind of switched a little bit ahead of time. This is even more on Friday. Our focus from science to faith traditions, and put the question this way: how do we hymn the planet in the Anthropocene, in this new epoch, when we've gone from the late Holocene, the only geological epoch known to human beings to this point, at least settled human beings? Hunters and gatherers were earlier on than the late Holocene, to the early Anthropocene, called that because human beings have collectively become the single most powerful force of nature itself and impact all natural systems, including those in the ocean and the high atmosphere, including places we don't live at all, the high Arctic or the Antarctica. We've impacted every single natural system, either by being present or by having the powers that influence, for example, the chemistry of the atmosphere and the chemistry of the ocean. So that we're in a new time. So how do we hymn the planet as people of faith this time becomes the question. But I finished on Monday. We had a brief discussion that I would like to continue right now. The question then was, what tugs at you, having seen the journey of the universe? But the question today was the one I announced on Monday. What lingers with you? What didn't leave your mind, heart, and soul when you walked out at 12:30 last Monday? What has stuck with you? What have you wondered about? What have you reflected about? Let's just open it up there and ask either one of those questions. What tugs at you, or what still tugs at you? Yes.
The perspective setting, the big picture. We get so in our own world, lives, immediacy,
yeah,
and the step back and understand the much bigger picture.
Yeah. Yeah. Good. Yeah, I mean, the dimensions of creation are dimensions that actually far exceed what our own faith traditions have. Even though in the Hebrew Bible you can have this standing in awe and wonder before the firmament. And the prophets can talk about creation with beautiful images, but they didn't have a clue as to how big that creation was, how deep it was, how it functioned. I mean, you had a human. I think it's hardwired isn't a good image, I think, but I think it's kind of hardwired into us to always want to make connections with a bigger story than our own. But nonetheless, we constantly shut down on big stories. And there's a reason for that. We had a discussion this morning among faculty, and Nadia quoted someone saying, they're always trying to pick one story to live our life by, and it's probably to shut down on others that might be threatening to us. We're always shrinking this at the same time that we've got an impulse that says, it tries to answer the fact that we deeply sense that we belong to something larger than our brief moment in time and our brief life span in time. So that journey is the journey of the universe. Like I quoted Joanna Macy. I just try to act my age. My atoms are 14 billion years old. So understanding ourselves as a part of that story gives us a different perspective. We'll get to that. Now, I did put up here the immutable laws of the journey, the immutable laws of how the universe functions. And these laws carry on. These laws weren't legislated by any human beings, and there isn't any agency, including the EPA, that can amend them. They are there. They will continue. One is the law of differentiation. To be is to be different. Everything in the universe is a part of nature that cherishes novelty. To be is to be different. The galaxies are not all the same. We'll get a little bit of that later. Solar systems aren't the same. Planet systems aren't. Moreover, they don't stay the same once they're there. Earth, a million years ago, was vastly different from Earth now. So there is this law of novelty. To be in the universe is to be different. We don't always, and that includes us. Human beings are always breaking the mold. If I were in charge of the Roman Empire, ain't going to happen. But if I were in charge of the Roman Empire, what I would try to remember is that no empire will survive forever. Because you cannot control being different. Somebody, some people, some folks are going to say, no, we don't accept that. So the notion of mastery and control that the Industrial Revolution had, depicted in a different example, that we can master nature and control it, runs up against an immutable law of the universe itself. It's true of species. Species arise because some members of the species had advantages, and that others were disadvantaged by that. So species arise and species die. There's this impulse in the universe. The second law of the universe is the technical term, and this is from the astrophysicists. Autopoiesis. There's a self-organizing impulse. Things aren't random out there and forever stay that way. They get organized. Gravity organizes the dust into galaxies and stars, waves of materials into stars. And that again is just a constant element of all creaturely life and all both biotic and abiotic. A self-organizing capacity. And if you remember the film on Monday, the chief factor here is gravity. Gravity is what pulls things together and kept the universe from simply becoming dust. Creating forms. Santa Fe is the bumper sticker capital of the world. And my favorite one, although I've only seen it once, is gravity isn't just a good idea, it's the law. It's also a good idea. We wouldn't be here had it not been for gravity being essential to this self-organizing capacity of things. All right. And the third one, Thomas Berry calls communion, sometimes called subjectivity. There's something which is something like a universal impulse to connect, to belong, if you will. We don't really have the human word vocabulary yet, I think, for this. Maybe we'll find the vocabulary. These are very human words: connecting, belonging, communicating, organizing. And I don't know if we're smart enough to find the right words that don't filter it through our associations. I don't know. Franz De Waal, who spends his life studying animals, says the more he studies animals, the more convinced he is that human beings aren't smart enough to understand what some of the things they know to do and be. But so I don't know if that's exactly the right word, subjectivity. But do you remember from Monday's documentary that Brian Swim says, the renowned physicist, Freeman Dyson, says, the more he studies the structures of the universe, the more he's convinced that life had to happen. No. So that I think is what is associated here with subjectivity or communion. Connection, belonging. Okay, those are the laws of the universe. Now well, your comments sent that off. What other things linger? Yes, back at the window.
Oh no, I had a question about these three things.
Go ahead.
What about entropy?
Yeah, very good. Yes, things are always falling apart too. Yes, and that's a law of the universe. That should be up here.
Is it a balance or a clear contradiction to autopoiesis?
It's part of the chain.
Yeah, I think that's right, that it's with it, the organizing will still go on, but it'll go on in a different form, and you cannot return to the capacity that you had at a certain point there. But that's a very good, the second, the laws of entropy. I mean, when you put the ice cubes in your bourbon and they melt in your bourbon, you're never going to get ice cubes again. They're lost for that capacity, but it's a different drink now, slightly. Yeah.
The self-organizing capacity can also be done at the cellular level, or really, if you take the basic chemicals, fats and stuff, and put them together, they will organize into
So there's that level also. Did everybody hear that? The self-organizing capacity is reflected at the cell level. If you take those chemicals and put them together, they will organize by themselves. And I think, thank you for that, because that's also related to what Barry is trying to get at here with communion. Only maybe we should say awareness there. Yesterday, or Monday, I talked about Ursula Goodenough, who's a cell biologist, saying that there's an awareness on the part of each cell. There's a membrane around the cell that is aware of its environment and responds to it. You know, we're not talking about mind, we're not talking about human consciousness, but we are talking about a capacity to respond to the environment. Okay, there were a number of other questions. What lingers with you?
I realized as I was listening to the video that gravity played a really important part early, and I thought, now I didn't hear them explain gravity when we're talking about how things began with the stars.
Yeah. I think that will come up today, and we're going to do an interview today about the life of stars. So I think the answer will come there, but you're right. It wasn't there. Yes.
So in these laws, I hear, and I wonder if you hear and other people hear, echoes of and resonances with process theology.
Yeah. Yeah. Process theology. Origins are in a philosopher, Alfred North Whitehead, but that the process philosopher, John Cobb, is the one who helped create this, and it's not by coincidence that process theology was the first and major theology in the modern era for ecological theology, precisely because of this process, that they were well aware of this. So that connection is not coincidental. Yeah. It just fits beautifully. Everything is in process, and everything is in change, but it's not random. Yeah.
So these are kind of all part of the same conversation in a way.
Yeah. Yes. Yes. Okay. What else?
How widely accepted is that we're moving into a new epoch?
The Anthropocene.
In the scientific community.
Yeah. What is accepted is, well, let me say first what geologists require. What geologists require is some laying down of something on the planet over what has been here before. that is planetary, that indicates this. So when they found the layer of iridium, and that was the fallout of the monstrous meteor that wiped out the dinosaurs, not by hitting every one of them, but by the cloud of dust that darkened the sun and cut off healthy air and things. That layer of iridium was the geologist's evidence of that event, and that it was of geological significance. When they find these things, when these things happen and they find them, they pound in a golden spike, Don't ask me. I don't know where that comes from. So there's one in Tunisia at this layer where they got. Where we are at present on that way of measuring a new epoch is this. The geologists are convinced that we're in a new geological epoch. They just can't agree on when it started. Did it start with the agricultural revolution, when human beings went from hunter-gatherer into settled society and started shaping the land masses around them? What's the evidence? Is the evidence all the plastic? I mean, you got a gyre of plastic in the ocean the size of Texas. That's affecting the life of the oceans and its creatures. So what the debate is now is the documentation of when this started and what kind of shape. Did it start with the Industrial Revolution? Did it start with the A-bomb? Was that a fundamental change? So the answer is yes and no. The answer is yes, we moved into the time of the dominance of human activities. Nobody's affecting all systems. Nobody's arguing that. And that's the reason for the name. What the argument is about is origins and evidence. Yeah. Yes?
And just to comment on that, if you look at the different geological golden spikes that have been driven in the past, there's still debate about what particular event caused that, because there may be multiple events, and so we're dealing with multiple events.
That's a good qualification. Maybe the agreement will be that there are multiple events and not just one. Yeah, good. All right. Other questions, other comments? I saw some other hands, so I know we haven't tapped everybody here. Yes?
One thing that struck me in the film is that the creation of the universe is ongoing. And
yeah.
It's also kind of compared, at least the way I interpreted it, to sort of a living being.
Yes.
And that was sort of the concept of it.
Yeah. There, James Lovelock especially, came up with a theory of Gaia, it's called the Gaia hypothesis, which says the planet is a self-regulating being, living being. And that was highly controversial when Lovelock posed that hypothesis. Living maybe is one of the adjectives there that you'd have to spend some time with. But what has developed in the last decade is what is called Earth system science, and maybe you and others know about that. Earth system science talks about the interaction of multiple forces of the planet itself. So it's not enough to talk about what's happening to ecosystems. That doesn't explain all of the changes. You also need to say what's happening in plate tectonics. Is there something going on there that will affect the number of volcanoes or earthquakes or some such things? So Earth system science tries to relate all of the major factors impacting the planet. And that's a different kind of science than the individual ones, environmental studies or geology. But what's the integration there? And much of that comes out of the contention that the planet itself is a self-regulating, maybe living system. Yeah, and it's ongoing. Yeah.
I was going to say that mine's more elementary. That an affirmation for me, a take-home for me, was that humanity is not on this earth to use the earth, but we are here as part of the system that cares for the earth, which is to say, basically, but also dispensable. You know, if we were to screw this up, you you know, I mean, it'll move on.
Yes.
To other things, people, beings that might do a better job of this.
Yeah.
And that's kind of a sobering reminder that I'm not here to just use the earth. Or when I say me, I collectively, which is a very disturbing thing.
Yes. Yeah, and this book, my book, and about what needs to change. One of them, things that needs to change, is to move away from an ethic which is only utilitarian, a master-slave ethic, in which the rest of nature is slave for human well-being and human use. There's much more to life, human life, than that. Brian Swim ends talking about wonder and awe and humility. To stand as a species in the midst of this kind of grandeur evokes something from us that is different from it's all about us. It's all about my material well-being. And we're probably most deeply human when we stand in awe and wonder and humility in the presence of God in the form of the universe as our story. That you've got to have a conversation here, because our own stories of origin say not just have dominion, but we're made in the image of God. So maybe it is all about us. I mean, that's how we've tended to interpret it. Now, scientifically, it doesn't work. That is, how can it be that a universe that is 13.78 billion years old, and if you were to project that on, if that were to be one page, and then you carved up the page into segments of time, we occupy the last minute on that page. I don't think it's all about us. No. But to understand that we're part of that story, and then to see what is evoked in us. The last interview we will have, and that'll be on Friday, is with a poet. And I think the artists are absolutely indispensable in helping us make the transition. Because if our making the transition is grounded only in fear, fear not, if it's grounded only in fear that we better get this right, and we probably won't come to the place where we occupy ourselves as a different species. Now, because this is the dilemma of the Anthropocene, however, because we have the powers that we have, the responsibility is ratcheted up. Here's a new book by Yuval Harari, who did a very good book called Sapiens, A History of the Human Species. And his new book is Homo Deus, A Brief History of Tomorrow. Homo Deus, humanity is God. I don't know if you have the skill set. I don't have the skill set for that. But his point is, and the point of a lot of people is, that we exercise such power that we're determining the future of evolution itself on this planet. We're exercising powers that redound to the third and fourth generation, to use biblical language, and beyond. We're doing things where we can't see the consequences of what we do. One person says, we're the gods now, we better get good at it. And by that person means we're exercising that kind of power, which Harari calls Homo Deus. And so that's a huge question now for our conversations with our own faith traditions. How do we exercise the powers we have? Or, if you want, back off of them. That's also our decision. You know, you can back off of technologies, or you can say the technology has to meet the following criteria, which are then criteria of sustainability, as best we can see. But those are all decisions. So everything is an ethical choice. Your breakfast is a moral issue. What food, where did it come from, at what benefit and what cost to the land and the people? Coffee? I have to have my coffee in the morning. I met another person who was holding the door and I was walking in. She said, yeah, you need to get your coffee, if otherwise somebody will get hurt. If I don't have my coffee in the morning, somebody might get hurt. Okay, but what is the, what that, you know, my diet is a moral issue. So there isn't anything now that isn't an ethical issue when you exercise powers that ramify through systems like we have. All right, what else? And then we'll dial up something. Yes?
So when we look at the advent of the Anthropocene, like anthropologically, how much influence did Christian dominionism in the West actually have on that, do we think? Or do we think like that globally and as a species we were headed toward this moment, you know, like without or in spite of that
yeah.
ideology and its coupling with the power of empires? Like,
yeah.
how much are we to blame for this?
Yeah. That big arguments around that, it was started in 1967 with an article by Lynn White in the magazine Science. And it was, the article was on the historical responsibility for what was then becoming increasingly an eco problem for the Earth. And Lynn White, as a historian of science, says the burden has to be laid at the feet of Christianity. And he cites the Genesis Dominion text. He goes on to say that, however, it isn't the churches, actually. It's that Christianity had such an influence in the culture that embraced the Industrial Revolution in the form of dominance, and this utterly utilitarian ethic. So it was the culture-forming powers of Christianity out of the Middle Ages, and then spread around the world in the conquest and colonization. Every continent except Antarctica had European or neo-European societies because of conquest, colonization, commerce, and Christianity. So he said that's what he means by laying the burden there. That doesn't absolve us from who are claiming that faith from addressing it. But I just want to make clear that what he sees as a cultural force. Now, it might have happened anyway. I think when human beings have that kind of power, they will do what they can to order life on their terms. And the power is fossil fuel in the form of stored energy, and then the invention of the steam engine so that you could build habitats anywhere. And you didn't have to depend just on the sun or the seasons. The built environment could overshadow the unbuilt environment and use it. So that's that. What's interesting in Lynn White's article, as he said, okay, the source of the problem is the power of a religious tradition to shape culture. So what does he do? He says, it will probably have to be a religious tradition that gets us out of this. and he says, it might be an old tradition renewed. It might be a new one. Creative, but it probably has to go to people's souls and to their spirit and to who they are. as human beings in order to make that shift. And that won't only be by science and technology, because it's a question of meaning and identity. And that's a religious cosmology question. And then, so Lynn White, after laying the blame at the foot of Christianity as a historian, says he's going to make his nomination, and he nominates Saint Francis as the patron saint for this viable alternative. You know, I think it's wonderful that the Pope, who created the most powerful indictment of the modern world in the form of an encyclical, Laudato Si, and tries his best to, by dialoguing with historians, science, and business people, tries his best to offer an alternative, takes the name Francis, because of Francis's love for creation and love of the poor. The cry of the earth and the cry of the poor together drive the alternative. Yes?
And also during the Crusades in the 12th century, went across the DMZ to spend 5 days with the Sultan.
Yes, that was Francis. Yes, Christian-Muslim relations.
But against his own bishops and etc.
Yeah. No. Extraordinary. Okay, anything else here about what's on your mind? Okay. Then we'll see what we can do. Well, I'll pick up some other things next time. The question that was picked up right away last time that we didn't follow through on, and that is vital, is where is God in the journey of the universe? And Nyla and I were talking afterwards, and she suggested what in fact is Luther's reply, and that is everywhere. And for Luther, I don't know if I have... So I said I wasn't going to do this, but I'm going to do it. Luther belongs to a tradition that in theology, that technically is called panentheism. Paul says, all is in God, and God is in all. Luther says exactly the same thing. There isn't a grain in which God is not wholly present. There isn't a leaf in which God is not wholly present. God is in, with, and under all that is. In, with, under, and around all that is. That's actually a formula for Luther. Pan is all, en is in, and theism or theism, theos, is God. God is in all of this. The Orthodox tradition, Eastern Orthodox tradition, I think African Orthodox tradition as well, one of their understandings of God is God is the uncreated energy of the created universe. So energy is a constant flow through all that is. God is the uncreated energy of the created universe. That's panentheism. So the Orthodox tradition is panentheistic. Sacramental traditions like Anglicanism, Roman Catholicism, Lutheranism are also panentheistic. Although we've tended to so limit the understanding of salvation to be an understanding of something that runs on an axis between God and human beings. They're the only object of salvation, not in the panentheistic tradition. It's like the Hebrew Bible. Redemption in the Old Testament, in Christian Old Testament, in the Hebrew Bible, is redemption of people and the land together. All things are redeemed, the subject of redemption. Come to the point of the flourishing for which they were created and have the capacity for. So, where is God? One answer is it's in all of it, from the Big Bang to the ongoing processes. Now, let me try. Well, let's back up here. This is our, I said your breakfast is a moral issue, and all of our choices now are ethical choices. This is a graph that shows how we've understood our moral responsibility, our responsibility as human beings. The inner circle is the circle of human-to-human relationships, or the inner circle is the circle of human society. The outer circle is all of planetary creation. Well, I just call it the ecosphere because that's how some of the scientists refer to the whole the whole lot. And then beyond that, the Earth belongs to the cosmos. We have, especially since the Industrial Revolution, understood responsibility to be human to human only. And every ethic, every full-bodied ethic is made up of three elements. There's virtue, what are the qualities of our character? What are the qualities, the values and qualities of the society, the internalized qualities? So if humility in the face of all things is something we internalize, that's a virtue of us, and then vices are usually the corruption of virtues. But then the second element of every full-bodied ethic are the consequences of our actions. And then the third element of any full-bodied ethic are moral bottom lines. Where do we stand? Here I stand, I can do no other. This is above all important. If I'm a fully convinced pacifist, what my moral bottom line is that I will take no human life. So I cannot vote for the death penalty, for example. But everybody's got their moral bottom lines, where their sense of obligation stands. Protection of my family. Care for the kids. Those are moral bottom lines. Doesn't matter what the circumstances are, that's gonna remain. So those moral bottom lines are fundamental duties. The consequences of our action, the utility of our action, and our virtue belong there. And we have understood moral responsibility in terms of our responsibility to one another as human beings. Not everybody has always done that. Most indigenous peoples understand their moral responsibility to include earth, air, fire, and water as a part of who they are and what they're responsible for. Now, we've come to the point where we have to do that. And so the shift, as a consequence of that, is that our moral responsibility now goes to all of the elements of the ecosphere. And the earlier one that I showed you, our actions had effects outside strictly human-human relations, but they were all moral externalities. So we impacted rivers and trees and the chemistry of the ocean and the atmosphere without taking account of it in making our choices. And a moral responsibility now has to be coterminous with planetary reality. Okay, we got... I'll show you Church, Christ Lutheran Church in San Diego, and what they did out of a Bible study of Ezekiel 47 and John 22. John 22 is a heaven, new heaven and a new earth. Ezekiel 47 is where the rivers of life flow from the temple of God through the streets of the city. And there are trees of life along the banks. They put their, when they built their new church, in the background you see the trees of life, which is from Genesis. That's the tree in the center of the garden, not the tree of knowledge of good and evil. That one gets all the press. The crucial one is the tree of life and how you live in service to the tree of life. Well, there are your trees of life in the background, and then the blue, this is a mosaic. Mosaic artist has the rivers of the waters of life flowing from the throne of God. And it flows under the communion table, and it flows past the other waters of life, baptism. So what's the relationship between the waters of life of baptism and the waters of literal waters of life becomes the image and the question. We don't, what does celebrating Eucharist have to do with diet, nutrition, agriculture, where we get our food? What does the sacramental treatment of food have to do with the requirements of life itself? What is the sacramental use of water have to do with Railroad Creek and Lake Chelan? That becomes a question when your moral universe expands. Well, it should have been the question before, and connections have been made. But it, now it is because of necessity. There's a picture of the trees of life. And it's not by coincidence that you have the firmament of heaven. This is the journey of the whole universe, galaxies included. What doesn't show on these pictures is that the rivers of the waters of life flow out the doors and into the community. They just go down the steps. They spread out. Because you're not here to stay here with your faith. You're dispersed as the church scattered in the community, and the community at the in the service of the church. All right. Enough is enough unless I have a... Well, we finish here and then we'll go to the interviews. This is a climate summit. You see all the people gathered there? Things on the board: energy independence, reserve rainforest, sustainability, green jobs, livable cities, renewable clean water, air, healthy children, etc. And then they're debating climate change. But what if climate change is a big hoax and we create a better world for nothing? All right. This is the end. This is the period. This goes back 800,000 years. And the late Holocene is this block here. The temperature, average temperature, doesn't vary beyond 1 degree Celsius above the baseline and 1 degree Celsius below the baseline. The tattoo of the late Holocene is climate stability. So you can count on the seasons. Now there's lots of variations, but overall it's a repetition of climate in such a way that it's climate stability. And then what has, this is 2008 observed, you've spiked this. Remember our J curves? You've spiked that with the activity, and this is the trajectory it's on, which is more than that range of one below the baseline and one above the baseline. And the mark of the Anthropocene looks to be climate instability, climate volatility as the contrast. I've got to get to the DVD now.
Where is that church located?
San Diego, Christ Lutheran Church, San Diego, California. Yeah.
Are those real trees?
Those are not real trees. No. It's all murals. It's all mosaic. I mean, not murals, mosaic. Okay. And we'll go to disc one. We have to turn it on again. Yeah. Maybe. If some of you were not here Monday for the full documentary on Journey of the Universe, there will be excerpts from that at the beginning of each of these interviews that will serve as just enough to kind of set the context. So let's have... Yeah, I forget. We'll have the introduction here. Whoops. By Mary Evelyn Tucker. One of the...
Welcome. I'm Mary Evelyn Tucker, and I teach at Yale University in a program on world religions and ecology. This course is an invitation into a new integration of sciences and humanities. For the first time, we're gaining an understanding of a story of our 13.7 billion year history, a unifying story, an integrating story, where these disciplines are bringing us to a new and deeper understanding. All peoples have had their stories, their cosmologies. A cosmology is a sense of where we come from, why we're here, where we're going. And now, for the first time, we have all the parts of a new cosmology from these various disciplines. But this is a cosmology which gives us, like earlier peoples, a new story of the meaning and beauty of our world, and most importantly, of our place in it. This educational series will take us on an immense journey from the beginning of the universe to galaxies forming, to the emanating brilliance of stars, to the birth of the solar system, then to life's emergence, and to learning, living, and dying. Then the passion of animals, and the origin of the human, and finally to becoming a planetary presence. We will then move into section 2, Emerging Earth Community, where we will be in conversation with a variety of individuals who are inspired by the story to create new ways of living, new human-Earth relations.
All right, we're going to jump down to galaxies forming. And then we'll watch the emanating brilliance of stars, and then we'll go to the passion of animals. This precedes the interview.
Morning on a Greek island is like the first day of creation. And wandering around here, you feel like the first person. Inevitably, humans would ask, what gave birth to all of this beauty? What was the form of creativity that brought this form? Consider galaxies. What brought the galaxies forth? You know, even a century ago, this is hard to imagine, we didn't know if there were two galaxies in the entire universe. That was the main focus of attention among scientists. Now we know there are 100 billion, maybe even a trillion galaxies. What is the creativity that brought forth a trillion galaxies? Let's consider our own Milky Way galaxy. It's a galaxy with huge spiral arms. Now, when we first began to discover galaxies, we thought maybe these spiral arms were composed of physical matter. But actually, it's much more interesting. The arms are actually waves that are passing through the galaxy. They're called density waves. And as they pass through clouds of hydrogen and helium, they ignite star birth. That's the way to picture the Milky Way galaxy. Not so much as a thing, but rather as an activity. It's an ongoing activity of bringing forth thoughts. We live in the midst of this intense creativity.
Todd, welcome. It's so good to see you.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
As a cosmologist and as a person who's teaching science for the larger public, we're delighted to have you here and to share your knowledge. We'll begin with the big scale, shall we?
Okay.
Let's begin with the story of galaxies and the fact that 100 years ago we were thinking the Milky Way was the only galaxy in the universe. What happened to expand our knowledge of the size and scale of the universe and galaxies?
Yeah, so that's probably one of the most amazing stories of human history, actually, is the fact that we've gone from thinking that all the little fuzzy spiral things that you could see in telescopes, spiral nebulae, which basically means spiral cloud fairly nearby, just clouds like other kinds of clouds you'd see in the night sky. And the key piece that broke through that was being able to have telescopes and techniques to be able to measure distances to some of those objects by actually finding stars in them. And this was pioneered by lots of people, but Henrietta Leavitt is one of the astronomers who played a key role in being able to make that happen, and Edwin Hubble. And around the early 1900s, people started being able to measure distances to galaxies like our Andromeda galaxy, and found out the modern distance is about 2.5 million light years away. And so that was just the beginning, sort of wading out into the surf a little bit of being able to realize that now we can actually measure distances to galaxies that are over 10 billion light years away, which means that it takes light going at 300,000 kilometers a second, 10 billion years to get from that object to us. So just, you know, it's really hard to wrap your mind around how much that expands, how big our universe is. You know, if you stand and look out on a field, or look out at the ocean, and you sort of comprehend how big the Earth is, and then you try to picture how much bigger, you know, it takes light way less than a second to go around the Earth, and to be able to talk about distances where it takes 10 billion years, it's hard to comprehend how much that changes your perspective.
It's staggering, isn't it? And the fact that Andromeda we can see with a naked eye, even on a clear night and so on, but tell us about galaxies. Are there different kinds of galaxies, and then how were they formed?
The general type, like our own, is actually a barred spiral galaxy. So it's just like the name sounds, it's a spiral shape with kind of a bar shape in the middle. Then there are just pure spiral galaxies, is another class. And then there are irregular galaxies, which, as the name implies, they're just sort of funny-looking shaped things or blobs. And then there are elliptical galaxies, which are sort of football-shaped. And the basic formation process for galaxies is, I think, a really fun example of how simple principles can produce really complex, interesting systems. Basically, they're all driven by gravity. So the way I like to think of it, the whole evolution of the universe from a cosmologist's point of view is going from, at one end, from simple and smooth at the early parts of the universe about 14 billion years ago to clumpy and complex, which is what we have now. So a lot of cosmology is understanding how we got from simple and smooth to clumpy and complex, which we're very grateful for because we're clumpy and complex. So the basic understanding of the process is that at the early stage, the universe was very, very hot and dense and smooth, dominated by radiation, light radiation. And so everything was very evened out. So you could picture it just like a lot like if you were inside the sun, just, you know, glowing hot, everything smooth. The universe is expanding, which is a piece that has only been recently discovered and is important to this. But there's a competition going on that as it's expanding. If you get one little region that, for whatever reason, gets a slight extra bit of material there, there's a really simple law of gravity that says that every bit of material pulls on every other bit of material. And so if you get a little bit of extra in one region, then it'll tend to grow. Imagine if you have a particle sitting here, and if all around it were other particles evenly distributed, then they'll all pull equally and it won't go anywhere. But if you get a little bit of a clump somewhere, now there's a little extra pull in one direction, so the clumps tend to grow. It's like you're, you know, stirring gravy or something and you get a little clump one place. So the galaxies formed really tiny quantum fluctuations in the very, very early universe that were just tiny seeds that then grew over time into these clumps that, as they gathered more and more material, they became the galaxies that we see. And if you look at pictures of galaxies on the Hubble website or something like that, recently they look like sort of a saucer. They're flattened. Is because if they're spinning even just a little bit, which they always kind of will be as these particles are kind of gathering together under gravity, if they're spinning a little bit, then probably everybody has seen the phenomenon when an ice skater pulls his or her arms in. If you're spinning a little bit and you pull in tighter, you spin faster. And this is a law of physics called the conservation of angular momentum that makes that happen. When that happens, as the galaxy shrinks, it starts to spin faster and faster because of that. And when something's spinning fast like that, it also tends to flatten out if it's able to. So think about spinning pizza dough or something on your fingers, right? It flattens as it spins. You have this matter coming together. It starts spinning, which means it flattens out. And in the process, you end up getting these disks that we see as galaxies today. And one of the other things that happens, but maybe not so obvious, is it turns out that they form spiral arms. It's similar to a traffic jam on a road on Earth.
Right.
And the stars are now orbiting the galaxy. And if you look at the spiral arms, you might think that it's like a rigid structure. And like if you cut a spiral out of paper or cardboard and spun it around like a pinwheel or something. But in fact, the spiral structure that you see pictures of, it's not always the same stars. So the stars are moving through the spiral pattern. And so it really is just a pattern of kind of a wave of density that's cycling through the galaxy. And just like in a traffic jam where there are different cars, they participate at different times, right? So you can be watching from a helicopter and you can see there's a traffic jam that people are stuck here, but cars are slowing down and then moving out the other side. And then a new car comes in, slows down, and the traffic jam is moved out the other side. So the cars are moving through, maybe not as quickly as they would like to be, but they are moving through, but the pattern stays intact.
And what about our Milky Way galaxy? Give us a feel for its shape. And
So our Milky Way galaxy is called the Barred Spiral. So it's a spiral that has two pretty distinct spiral arms from what we've been able to tell. It's somewhat difficult to map it because we're inside of it.
Right.
So it's a big challenge in astronomy of being able to do that. And then it's about 100,000 light years, if you were sort of the long way across the saucer. So you think about that for a minute and realize this is just within our own Milky Way galaxy. You could travel at the speed of light, it'd take you 100,000 years to get from one side to the other. And on average, it's about 1,000 light years thick. It's thicker in the middle and thinner out at the edges. And then there's also a halo of what are called globular clusters that are groups of older stars that are they're in sort of a halo pattern, more circular, more a spherical shape around the outside. And then the part that we don't see that is almost certainly there, probably 10 times bigger than the galaxy, visible part of the galaxy that we see. There's pretty strong evidence that there's a dark matter halo that was actually the matter that originally sort of formed the gravitational structure that brought the visible part of the galaxy. And that's,
yes.
If we want to talk about that, it's a big mystery of what is this dark matter that makes up like 90% of the matter of the universe.
More interview with Todd Duncan. We'll play the next room.
Good
Come into this little church. I want to show you something. The ceiling, as you can see, is filled with stars. The same is true of most of the churches on the island of Samos. The ancient Greeks, like Pythagoras, thought the stars were alive, even divine. Throughout history, every culture has been stunned by the presence of stars in the vastness of the night sky. So deeply moved by the majesty emanating from the brilliance of the stars, we have built our lives around them. We've even organized entire civilizations upon their beauty and order. Here's the essence of the universe story. The stars are our ancestors. Out of them, everything comes forth. Stars are dynamic entities. They're born, they develop, they even die. Starbirth occurs when gravity squeezes together a cloud of atoms so tight that nuclear fusion ignites in the center. In the process, hydrogen fuses into helium. This nuclear energy expands outwards and opposes gravity. So stars represent an amazingly creative balance between the powers of gravitational collapse and nuclear explosion. And once a star's nuclear fuel is spent, there's nothing left to prevent gravity from collapsing inwards, causing the death spiral to begin. This super concentrated dot of matter, which we call a supernova, explodes outward with the power of 100 billion stars. And as it expands, it creates all of the elements: phosphorus, oxygen, carbon, gold. These are spewed out into the Milky Way galaxy, and then the whole process starts again. They drift as a cloud, and then they collapse, give birth to a star, the Earth. It's by this stupendous process that we can say the stars are our ancestors. It's just such an amazing discovery. The carbon atoms of this beet and of the lettuce and of, you know, our brains, our skin, all of it passed through an intense explosion of a star. In pondering the source of the sun's power, we can now reflect on something no earlier humans could know. The sun is converting 4 million tons of its mass into energy every second. All of life feeds on the roaring energy of the sun. Our solar system then is a self-energizing womb of creativity. And all of this had its start in a cloud of dust.
Stars, though, they're part of this whole galaxy system, and how did they emerge?
Yeah, so that's basically the same process, just on a different scale, and that's one of the, I think, the amazing things about knowing a little bit of physics, is that there are these simple laws, like the law of gravity, that apply on all these different scales, and you can see the same types of phenomena repeated over and over again. So just like the galaxies form on this big scale, out of this clumping process, on a smaller scale, you can have a cloud of material that something, maybe it's going through one of the density structures in spiral arms, or maybe it's a supernova, an explosion of a dying star that triggers a little bit of extra pressure and makes it a little bit denser. Something starts it collapsing, And then the same kind of thing happens where you have material starts collapsing, a little extra gravity here, which brings in more material. As it gets smaller, it starts spinning more, just like the ice skater again. That tends to flatten it out, which means that what you end up doing is you make not just the star, but you make the planetary system that we see, like in our own solar system, around it that forms out of that disk of material that collects. And that is on another scale, gravity coalescing things into planets that are the bits of material there. And then with a star, as it collapses, you can think of it as a battle between pressure, which would like to hold it up and blow it apart, maybe even, and gravity just wants to crush it. Because gravity only works one way, it's always attractive. So what happens is as gravity continues to work on making a star shrink, eventually it gets to a place where as you think about compressing a gas like air in a bicycle pump or something like that, it heats up. So if you get to a temperature of something like 10 million degrees, then it gets hot enough where a process called nuclear fusion can start to happen, which is tremendously important for us and our existence and the history of the universe. And I think the way to understand that is that let's think of the simplest example, which is you have two protons, both have a plus charge, so they don't like to be pushed together, they repel just like two bar magnets or something, you try to push the same ends together and you feel the push apart. But if they're moving fast enough, they can still get really close together, right? So even though they want to repel, if they're moving fast enough and they happen to be heading right toward each other, they'll get really close. And then if they get close enough, which is really, really close, it's about 10 to the power minus 14 meters, so that's a decimal point, 13 zeros and a 1. When they get that close, there's this force that takes over that's called the strong nuclear force. It's very, very, very strong. It's a very creative name, the strong force. And so if they can make it that close, then they stick. So it's a lot like you can almost think of it like if you're riding a bicycle up a steep hill. If the hill's really steep, you won't make it to the top if you don't have a lot of speed, which corresponds to the temperature being really high. And you might not know, unless you have enough speed to get there, that there's actually a cliff at the end, and that you keep finding that you roll partway up the hill and you go back down, you roll a little bit higher, you go a little faster, you roll back down, then you go fast enough and you actually go over the edge of the cliff and end up on the other side and you don't roll back down. So it's kind of the same way with the strong nuclear force. The electric force tries to push the protons apart. If they get close enough together, they fall off the cliff and they stick together. And it turns out that there's energy produced by that process that's released as light and heat. So if a star gets compressed enough, at that point, the star has this energy coming out that provides pressure that can hold it up. So there's a balance point. If you look at any star, it's almost like it's a nuclear explosion going on that's being contained by gravity. So there's this delicate balance going on between those two forces, one trying to blow it apart and one trying to pull it together. And a star like our sun can live in that state for something like 10 billion years. Staying roughly in balance and able to support itself against gravity and shine due to this nuclear fusion that's going on.
And provided all the sources of life.
Which provides the source of life directly and also other generations of stars. This process, when you fuse two protons together and then build on that, you go from hydrogen, you can build helium. Out of helium, you can build carbon and heavier elements. So generation after generation of stars going through this process, one way or another, has made all of the elements that fill in our periodic table and that make up, the material that's in your fingernails, in your blood, in your skin. So the only reason we're able to be here, the only reason the periodic table has anything basically other than hydrogen and helium in it is because of stars in that process.
Todd, give us this sense of the amazing emergence and death of stars and how the elements actually come out of this process.
Yeah, if you really stop to think of it, we should feel a lot of gratitude towards stars, I think, because for one thing, they go through very much a life cycle, just like we do. They have time when they're born, they have an infancy, they have a early, youth, they have a middle age, and they have a death, essentially. And the basic process is that stars collapse under gravity. They reach a point where there's a balance between the gravitational force trying to collapse them, the energy from nuclear fusion as they turn one element into another, helping to support it, so there's a balance. And then, depending on the type of star, depending on how much mass it has, at some point it runs out of fuel. More massive stars run out of fuel more quickly, kind of like rock stars, sort of the same deal, right? Shorter lives. So more massive stars can move more quickly. Less massive stars can live a lot longer. But eventually they run out of fuel, and if they're a less massive star, what happens is that they create what's called a planetary nebula, which are these beautiful images that you see in Hubble and elsewhere of material that is just sort of quietly floated away from the star while the middle part, the core of the star, forms into a white dwarf star. It's kind of a dying ember of a star. And those elements are then available to make stars and other planets and life like us. If you're a more massive star, you end your life in a supernova explosion, which more violently sprays all the rest of the elements in the periodic table out into the medium between the stars. And then that material is then available to be recycled into the, what's called the interstellar medium, the material between the stars. And that material can be recycled. And so when our sun came along, hundreds or thousands of generations of some kinds of stars had already done this processing. So when our solar system formed, we formed out of this recycled material in kind of the ecosystem of our galaxy. And so that material is now what makes up, you know, the carbon in your skin, the gold in your jewelry, the iron in your blood. All those things are literally stardust, either blown off violently or blown off quietly, depending on the type of star. But thanks to stars, we actually have all that material that enables life to exist.
It's an amazing lineage, isn't it? Our
it is.
Ancestry all of a sudden is extended so vastly into the very elements of ourselves and life on Earth.
That's absolutely right. If you think about tracing your ancestry back to your mother or father and her mother or father, you can trace it all the way back through, of course, all the different animals and organisms, but you can completely trace it back to there was, you know, the carbon that is in your fingertip lived in a star somewhere. That's part of your lineage.
Which is why it makes sense in a way, doesn't it, to tell this as a story, as our story.
Our common cosmic story.
Yeah, give us a feel for how you might see that, the significance of this lineage and story for humans.
The way I think of it is we kind of crave wonder, like we crave a sense that what we're doing is part of a mystery, part of something deep and meaningful, which is sometimes hard to see when you're studying for a test or you know, filling out income tax forms or whatever. You know, it's hard to see that as, it feels mundane, right? It's hard to see that as part of a magical, mysterious origin. But if you can understand your lineage, then you can really see, you know, every action you do is in a way frozen creation. If you can picture in your mind's eye the thread that connects whatever you're doing right in this moment to that lineage and then ultimately back to the ultimate question of how did it all begin, where did all this come from, then every action, you know, the test that you're taking, the driver that you're angry at that just cut you off in traffic, is part of that cosmic lineage, and it has sort of a mystery and a wonder to it that I think changes how you look at life and how you look at other people and how you look at other points of view in a way that you don't have if you're very narrow and you don't see that lineage.
I think that's so true and so beautifully put. And if we extend that lineage, what about the early universe? And give us a feel for what was emerging and again, how we're part of that, even this expansion of the universe.
We also owe our existence to the fact that the universe is expanding. And so we can think of tracing back that lineage as we did through the stars. The first stars were thought to have formed probably 100 million or a few hundred million years after the beginning of our current universe as we know it. So there was time before there were stars, and we can't trace it back to the very beginning, but we can trace it back to a time when all we know that it was just extremely hot and dense, and if you had a suit that would protect you from the heat and radiation, it'd be like looking around this glowing uniform suit. And something started that out, but we don't know. But everything was expanding, which drove everything else that happened, because if it hadn't been expanding, it wouldn't have cooled down. So there's this expansion that allows things to cool, and as things cool, it's very much like watching ice freeze, for example, right? You put a tray of water in your freezer, and it's very smooth and uniform. As it freezes, little imperfections, little irregularities crystallize out of the smooth water, and in a way, the history of the universe has been that sort of crystallization of structure out of that.
So in the early universe that you're describing, and with this wonderful image of ice freezing and so on,
What about the factor of time, and how did that help shape this universe in its early emergence?
One of the interesting things about the timeline is that in the very early universe, things happened very, very quickly. So, for example, there was thought to have been a time, a tiny, tiny fraction of a second, on the order of 10 to the minus 30 seconds, where there was this rapid period of inflation, where the universe expanded very, very rapidly, that created a lot of the seeds for the density regions that we talked about that formed galaxies and ultimately stars. And then, I guess a really significant event about a few minutes after the beginning is when the basic hydrogen and helium elements form. So, you know, we talked about our cosmic lineage in the stars. Elements beyond hydrogen and helium mostly formed in the stars. Hydrogen and helium were formed, imprinted a few minutes after the beginning of the universe. Another key event, much later on now, about a little less than 400,000 years after the beginning, was when, for the first time, it was cool enough that electrons and protons could stick together. Before that, it was too hot. So if an electron was stuck to a proton to make a hydrogen atom, it would fly away because there was too much energy bouncing around and it would stay free. The reason that was so significant is that was the point when the universe became transparent. So at that point, our ability to see across cosmic distances became available. And so if you've ever seen pictures of the cosmic microwave background, it's sort of this smooth early region, early phase, kind of like I've heard it described as baby pictures of the universe. You could actually see that smooth light from that time, because that was the first time when the universe became transparent, so that light could leave and get to us. And then, I guess one other thing about all that is that this expansion that we sort of take for granted as a backdrop is that if it had been expanding a little bit faster, everything would have just blown apart and there wouldn't have been time for all these structures to form. And if it was expanding a little bit slower, gravity would have just recollapsed everything right away and there wouldn't have been chance for things to form. There's a really interesting aspect of the universe that had to be sort of the way it is in order for us to be there. Gravity had to have a certain strength. Expansion rate had to be a certain amount. Strength of electric force had to be a certain amount. Speed of light had to be a certain amount. You know, all these things had to be the way they are in order for life as we know it to have any chance of ever coming into existence. It's right. Interesting to think about.
But I love, you know, even metaphorically, though, this idea of attuning the music of the spheres, so to speak. I mean, it's a symphony, right, that requires just these right conditions and chords and movement. It's quite extraordinary, isn't it?
It is.
Yeah, I'm just going to cut it off here. Yeah. All right, we just have a few minutes left, and instead of... We could get the lights here. Instead of another interview on the passion of the animals, let's just take a few minutes to respond to this. I'm blanking on her last name, Robin. She's the anthropologist hired by the New York City Department of Sanitation. Now, what Department of Sanitation has a house anthropologist other than New York? But Robin says, everything is garbage and everything is sacred. And what she means by that is that it's all recycled stardust. It's all garbage. It's all the garbage of stars, that supernova that blew up. And for her, it's all sacred as well. Now, the Journey of the Universe documentary doesn't use the language of sacred. They do use the language, like you heard from Todd Duncan, of wonder and mystery and awe. But when Mary Evelyn Tucker and Brian Swim talk with communities about this, they do use the language of sacred. And Mary Evelyn Tucker says, we live in a sacred cosmos. What could be more important than that? So I'm just wondering, as you listen to what is a presentation of science about the dynamics of galaxy formation and exploding stars yielding all the elements for the periodic table except helium and hydrogen, what is your response? Do you find anything in what Todd Duncan says that makes a difference if someone cuts you off in traffic? or how you're feeling when you're doing your income tax? Is there any connection for you between thinking about your own story, because we're all stardust, and thinking about your own identity as creatures of the cosmos? Is there, what kind of connections do you make with the rest of your life? Or what will this set you to thinking? Yeah.
Well, just listening to them talk and watching them talk and think and breathe and so forth, you try to make the jump from the sort of primordial ooze or this, you know, these collecting, you know, throwing out all of these elements, and then them forming and then becoming animals and humans and, you know, all this recycled material. And
yeah.
Kind of go, I can't get there. I can't make that leap to get there where they're talking about it and thinking about it. And, you know, I can see mountains formed. I can see it's really hard to get to living, breathing beings.
Yeah. One thing that's happening now that I think is helpful, and it'll be interesting watching what happens with our grandkids or that generation and what kind of education they get and how they think about themselves. I don't know if this story is going to be, I assume it's going to be a part of their routine education, even though it's, you know, as we heard, it's recent in even our own history. We only thought there were two galaxies and all that's changed. But in history and historical studies now, there is a move from history understood as the relationship of human beings to other human beings, groups of human beings, tribes to tribes, nations to nations, and so on. All of it centered on human society. There's a move from that to what is called big history. And big history is reading the human story as part of the planetary story. And the planetary story is part of the cosmic story. So I just think it'll be, I don't expect to be around all that long, but I think it would be fascinating if this becomes, that the big history is the history that the kids learn. And then getting our minds around that, you know, is especially hard for us probably. It just expands the boundaries and the borders in ways that we just haven't, it hasn't been a part of our cosmology. And our cosmology sets the framework for what we can and do perceive and understand. So if you change cosmologies, you change the way people see things, including themselves. Yeah. Or you can put it in other terms. This is an effort to find a different narrative about who we are in the grand scheme of things than the ones that has informed us. This is a big story. And if you change people's stories, you change their beliefs. There are two ways to change people's beliefs. One is friendship with someone who sees things differently from you, and hearing their stories, desperately needed in this country at this time. The other way to change people's beliefs is change the story. Because we're storytellers who live the stories we tell about ourselves. This is an effort to change the story on one level, namely the grand story, this story of creation. This is also, and we'll get into it on Friday, an effort to become what Mary Evelyn Tucker will call a functional cosmology. What difference does this make for race relations or for issues of class? for the relationship with the rest of creation, the passion of animals, which we didn't see today. But we're mammals. So what does that mean? We're relating to other mammals. Okay, what else do you have on your mind about what this science difference it might make? Yes?
So, as has been true all along, I guess, in human history, I am struck by the need to allow speech and to allow hearing and not suppress them. Hmm.
Can you say more? Can you say more, Newt? Speech on the part of and hearing on the part of means speech with one another or listening to?
Speech with one another.
Yeah.
Speech public, speech private.
Yeah.
Hearing public, hearing private.
Yeah.
And there are all kinds of reasons to suppress both speech and hearing. But one of our duties, one of our hopes, is to encourage it.
Yeah.
To allow it. To grow it.
Yeah. And as I mentioned at the outset this morning, there's a tendency in all of us to find a story and then to stick with it to the exclusion of other stories. And you're not going to have that conversation that you're talking about if our purpose of our story is to shut down the other stories. Yes, please. You look like you're about to say something on this. No?
No, oh. I'm just...
Yeah.
It's a whole new way of kind of approaching it, thinking about it.
Yeah.
Thinking the first thing, having formerly been a teacher, is, you know, how would you present this in a classroom?
Uh-huh.
Yeah, for young children.
Yeah, I don't know the answer to that, but I would be surprised if there aren't children's books on Journey of the Universe.
Reuse, recycle. That's what we did in our school.
Uh-huh. Okay, so you're starting that. But it would be fun to write children's books. Much, and then we're talking about junior high and high school, too. And I'm certain there are things going on there, efforts to do that. I'm not conscious. I haven't looked at them. I'd be very surprised if there aren't. But let me follow up on Newt's comments about recent discoveries about the science in the natural world. A couple of books, The Hidden Life of Trees and How Forests Think. And it's about an amazing communication that happens among trees, you know. And why you shouldn't plant trees individually, you should plant them within so that they grow within, that they can be in touch with one another through the root systems and then all sorts of little microorganisms that become a part of this. And a pest enters a forest and the trees have a capacity to communicate that invading pest to other trees, who then have a chance to protect themselves against this. I mean, that book, The Hidden Life of Trees, by a forester in Germany, yeah, is remarkable, and we're just finding out more and more. So, how do we listen to other creatures in the natural world, too, is another kind of listening. And we really haven't been open to letting trees be, in a certain sense, sentient creatures. Yeah. Yes?
I find this very hopeful because I see the power of God behind the universe. And
mm-hmm.
But then I wonder, before the universe, where was God?
Yeah. Yeah, that was one of the age. That's one of the age before time and space. You know, what was God up to? That's one of the oldest questions in theology and the unanswered one. And Thomas Berry, when he thinks about questions like that, always ends up talking about the great mystery. You know, and he doesn't mean mystery simply in the sense that we don't know, so it's mysterious. He means it in terms of a presence. God is the living presence behind as well as in all that is. Yeah, there was a hand right up against. No, okay, please.
Well, I'm also thinking about if we come to a point where we have large populations of people.
We're there.
It's a very different view of the universe and our position in it. How will this affect our laws, our lives together, and so forth, that have been built on a very different perception?
Well, that's happening. That's happening.
I think it is happening, but it is both scary and also has an element of hope.
Yeah. Yes, and I think the whole theme this week around fear and fear not is about both that which is scary and that which is generates energy for a different world and a sense of hopefulness about it. Just to mention a couple of things, and then it's time here. is it Bolivia or Ecuador, or is it both, that have constitutions in which nature other than human beings has rights and have claims upon human life? So the watersheds have rights. And likewise, I think the new the constitution for South Africa has ecosystems have a claim to water that human beings can't simply override. You have to learn how to divide it up so that all of them can flourish. That's when these things become part of constitutions, nature has rights. Then your biotic rights. Then you're also reflecting this kind of connectedness of interconnectedness of life itself. And you have to get back, though, to what I put on the board last time. Planetary health is primary. Human well-being is derivative. Yeah.
But that's a very different shift.
It is. It's a big shift for us. It isn't a big shift. We have 9 pueblos in northern New Mexico of Native Americans who have lived around there for 1,000 years. Not a big shift for them. They just nod their head, yeah. That's right. Yeah. Finally, the physics of their cosmology, Santa Clara Pueblo and San Ildefonso are right next to the Los Alamos National Laboratory, and they say, well, at last, the physicists at Los Alamos have caught up with our cosmology. Finally, there's an energy pervasive of all things living and non-living. That there's a spirit, they would call it spirit, a spirit presence in the universe. We would call it third person of the Trinity.
I am leaving on Friday. I might not be here to listen to your presentation on Friday, and I just want to say thank you.
Oh, yeah. Well, thank you. Thank you. Yeah. Well, if anyone else who's going out, know what I think Sharon said last night. Eventually, if you want to tap into these, eventually they'll be on the Holden website. But for now, like every other session I've been to at Holden, we kind of end on a semicolon. Pick it up later. We never get to a period around here. There's always one semicolon at the end of the next session.
Signing books. I missed your 2 o'clock. You're signing your book.
And well, I'm available anytime for signing books. Yeah, but there's not another one scheduled. Yeah, but there, sure, just bring it, find me. Yeah. Okay, thanks, everybody.